And welcome to today's webinar on defining disease response and progression, treatment resistance, failure, and or loss of response to JAK inhibition in myelofibrosis. I'm Prithvi Bose. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Leukemia at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. And I'm joined today by Dr. John Mascarenhas, who is a professor of medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, director of their adult leukemia program, and also clinical lead for their MPN clinical research program. Here are our disclosures. So to sort of set the stage for the overall, the overarching theme of what we are discussing today, there is an increasing recognition that that ruxolitinib failure is not a well-defined or well-understood entity. It is quite heterogeneous, as we will discuss through this presentation. And now that we are in an era where we have multiple FDA-approved JAK inhibitors and others on the horizon, and many other non-JAK inhibitors in development as monotherapy or add-on therapies, we're really in a new era where there are so many options for patients and going to be increasing over time. So to start with the formal criteria for a disease progression in myelofibrosis, this slide shows you the international working group criteria, which, as you notice, are really restricted to spleen progression and blast progression when it comes to defining progressive disease. So as you see on the slide, it could be new splenomegaly, worsening splenomegaly, which is defined differently based on what the baseline spleen size is. And then, of course, increasing blasts, post-MPN AML is, of course, 20% and higher. And then, as you see in the last bullet, there's some criteria about around the absolute blast count. John, what are your thoughts on these criteria? Obviously, fairly restricted not very comprehensive, I think. And also particularly, how do you think it translates to the real world when seeing a patient?
You know, I think it's an important point because in our practices, we do typically spend a lot of time and try to exact a measure of the spleen with a measuring tape, you know, usually at the midclavicular line and below the left costal margin, and we try to have reproducibility as we move along with treatments in order to assess change in spleen length. And that probably doesn't translate neatly into the community practice, where the pace and the tempo and the focus is different, and they're likely not measuring spleens in the same way and capturing in the note, you know, the distance from the left costal margins. I think the other point that is probably worth emphasizing is we often collectively obtain imaging of the abdomen and will obtain a spleen length either by ultrasound, MRI, or CAT scan. It's important to remind the listener that there is a difference between the length that one calculates from the imaging and then by palpation, because the imaging will capture the length from cranial caudal direction, whereas when you palpate, you're really only palpating a fraction of that because the rest of the spleen is hidden under the rib cage. So, you know, those two numbers are not the same and sometimes are confused when discussing spleen length of response or progressive disease.
That is also a bit of a segue into the fact that progression in real life is not restricted to just the spleen and increasing blasts. It can obviously take the form of worsening cytopenias. It could be worsening symptoms. It could be progressive leukocytosis. So certainly spleen and blasts are a little bit easier to quantify or formalize in the context of clinical trials. But for patients, often it is worsening cytopenias. I think that's probably the most common presentation of progression that I see. And then also symptoms and white count. Now, you and we and others have published on the outcomes after ruxolitinib discontinuation. And this is from our group, and this shows that the median survival after Rux discontinuation was 14 months. Very similar results from you, John, and Andrew Kirkendall at Moffitt, as well as the Italians. that you know, true RUX failure is bad. You have about 11 to 14 month survival. And then also shown on this slide is that if you have clonal evolution while you're on RUX prior to discontinuation, or if your platelets are dropping while on RUX, those further worsen the outcome after discontinuation. So building on this suboptimal scenario that we have for patients who discontinue RUX, there was a recent attempt by the Italian group led by Dr. Passamonti and also Andrew Kirkendall at Moffitt, who sort of validated the results, to develop a model that could help predict patients who are unlikely to do well on RUX after 6 months of treatment. And it turned out that there were three variables, no surprise here, fairly intuitive variables, but nice to see it formalized. There were three variables. One was the RUX dose. So if it was less than 20 BID at the baseline 3 months and 6 months, need for transfusions at baseline 3 months and 6 months, and also a less than a 30% reduction in spleen size by palpation at 3 and 6 months. At 3 or 6 months, these were all predictive of an inferior outcome on RUX for these patients.
And Prithvi, you know, maybe we can spend a minute here just talking about what would be the impact or utility of this RR6 model in the community practice. Because when I see this model, I find it very intriguing, actually, in many ways, and somewhat intuitive too. But there are a couple of things that impress me with this. One is that one of the independent prognostic variables is a dose less than 20 milligrams twice daily. And you and I know that that would actually encompass the majority of patients who are treated with ruxolitinib probably are on a dose at 0, 3, and 6 months of therapy of less than 20 milligrams twice daily. So it already, you know, emphasized the idea that dose matters and that's an important consideration. And that, you know, that's something I think that you and Serge Verstovic have really made a point over the years that one should try to optimize and maximize the dose to get spleen reduction, because here's an example of where it probably does actually correlate with the outcomes that matter a lot at the end of the day, which are survival outcomes. But I wonder if you can comment on what would be the utility in the community setting after 6 months of RUX for a community practitioner to do the RR6? What would they potentially gain from it or advise the patient to do?
Yeah, certainly. So as we've seen with some of the newer prognostic models, there is an online calculator, which is great. You always need these things to do these things in real time. But yes, John, you make a great point about the dose dependency of RUX. RUX is a highly dose dependent drug. I mean, you really see the best outcomes at least 15, if not 20 BID. And this model uses found that less than 20 BID was a factor predicting for worse outcomes. So I think that's extremely important, as well as, you know, not having enough of a shrinkage in the spleen and the transfusion part there. I think now with other options available and momelotinib perhaps coming next year, I think this it certainly helps. It provides a framework for the practitioner who may not be doing a lot of MF all the time, I think it guides them by somewhat formalizing these variables.
Yep, I think the other obvious benefit of this model too is for those patients who are transplant eligible, who you've put on ruxolitinib and they've met with the transplanters and now they're 6 months out, it may help provide some sense of balance of where transplant may fit in, given the clear compromise in survival if you have a high risk disease state with this model, that may push the decision for transplant sooner rather than later, and rather than waiting for the patient to ultimately fail ruxolitinib.
Absolutely. You always want to send them at the time of optimal response, and I think this helps you know that you're not getting there. Moving on from there, so some of the trials that have been done, the options that we have today and that may be coming. So starting with fedratinib, this was of course approved in August of 2019, and this is the second line study I'm showing you here, the Jakarta 2, obviously more relevant to our discussion today. Now this one was an open label single arm study, and you see some of the inclusion criteria on the left, and you notice that there wasn't really a definition of ruxolitinib failure. You just had to have had it for 2 weeks or more. Now, I should say the median was about 10 months. It certainly was not 2 weeks. The median prior rux was around 10 months. Platelets had to be over 50, and the dose was 400, which of course is the approved dose of fedratinib. And using sort of these criteria, the per protocol analysis was actually yielded remarkably good results for the spleen, 55% rate of spleen response and a 26% rate of symptom response at week 24. Again, remember, this is a per protocol analysis. So because of this and the fact that there wasn't any sort of requirement to be met. It was really sort of in the judgment of the treating physician as to who had failed ruxolitinib. Because of that perceived shortcoming, there was a reanalysis done using stringent criteria as are shown on the left of this slide. And as you see here, it's really to do with an insufficient spleen response or regrowth after a response, and also cytopenias, transfusion needs, etc., which would be more intolerance. So using these stringent criteria, they found that 79 of the 97 patients in this trial met these criteria, so 81%, so the majority. And when you looked at just this stringent criteria cohort, the spleen response was 30%. And the symptom response was 27%. Importantly, these numbers are identical, virtually identical, to the intention to treat results in this trial. So the ITT population had 31% spleen and 27% symptoms. And as you see, the stringent criteria was 30 and 27. So very, very close. And perhaps the difference, the obvious difference from the per protocol analysis also had something to do with the fact that, as you recall, this drug did have at the time a clinical hold forcing patients to come off. And for that reason, the last observation carried forward method was used. And so there was some extrapolation to 24 weeks based on the 12-week MRI findings. John, thoughts around fedratinib in general?
I mean, my experience with fedratinib is it's been a very welcomed addition to the armamentarium, and has has a clear response rate as shown here. So if you have patients who are not attaining the kind of spleen and symptom response with ruxolitinib or have lost their initial response, this is a very reasonable second line option in which a third of the patients enjoy significant symptom and spleen response. And what we're not showing you here in this specific slide is even the patients who didn't have the 35% SVR or 50% TSS still gained some degree of improvement that was better than being on ruxolitinib previously. So I think it's a very reasonable option. And what I liked about this reanalysis is it set a tone for, as you pointed out, a more stringent criteria, because the way the original study was designed was it was really left up to the investigator to make that call based on their feeling, but this creates a little bit more clarity and definition for failure.
Absolutely, and could sort of set the tone for future trials. So speaking of which, the PAC-203 study also actually used this definition. So just as a refresher, pacritinib, of course, was approved based on the PERSIST-2 trial that you led, John. And this study, the PAC-203, was a subsequent safety study that the FDA had asked for since there were some initial concerns from the PERSIST studies. And this study looked at patients who had previously had ruxolitinib, so it was all second line, and or beyond, I should say. And there were three doses, 100 once a day, 100 twice a day, and 200 twice a day, which of course is now the approved dose of pacrithinib. And again, the same definition as used in the reanalysis of Jakarta 2 was used here in terms of defining who was resistant or intolerant to ruxolitinib. Again, the point of this study was primarily safety.
Prithvi, thank you for passing the controller over to me. And here we're showing you the EMBARK trial. And this was a trial that was a multi-center phase 2 randomized study of two different doses of imetelstat, the telomerase inhibitor, in patients who had previously received ruxolitinib and were defined as relapsed or refractory, as shown here. So these patients were patients that had worsening splenomegaly-related abdominal pain at any time after the start of the JAK inhibitor, and either they had no reduction in spleen volume or size after 12 weeks of therapy, or worsening splenomegaly at any time after the start of a JAK inhibitor therapy. And you could document that either by imaging or by clinical notes demonstrating increase in spleen size by palpation. They also required the patients to have active symptom burden, and imaging at baseline to document a spleen that was at least 5 centimeters below left costal margin, or the equivalent by imaging, which is about 450 cubic centimeters. And what this study ultimately showed was, if you look at the survival and an intention to treat analysis shown here, there appeared to be an improvement in survival in blue in the patients who received the higher dose in this randomized study of imetelstat, which is infused every 3 weeks, at 9.4 milligram per kilogram, compared to, in green, the lower dose of 4.7 milligram per kilogram. So the median survival at the high dose was 29.9 months, and at the low dose was 19.9 months. And I think it's important to contrast this with the multiple studies that Prithvi has reviewed today that would suggest a median survival of approximately 14 to 15 months in this poor risk population. So this data would suggest a prolongation of survival, particularly with the high dose of drug. And this survival was true no matter how you looked at these patients, and sensitivity analysis was performed, and it really remained true even accounting for next lines of therapy after discontinuation of imetelstat. So this informed and inspired the ongoing IMPACT-MF study, which we're showing you here. This is a phase 3 study, a pivotal registration study of patients who have specifically refractory myelofibrosis that are intermediate 2 or high-risk disease, and they're randomized to either imetelstat at that higher dose, 9.4 milligram per kilogram every 21 days, or best available therapy, which is investigator-selected but excludes JAK inhibitor therapy. And what's unique about this trial and important is it has a primary endpoint of overall survival. So up to this point, really the endpoints that were considered meaningful and registration-worthy in myelofibrosis have been first and foremost reduction in spleen, and then more recently symptom improvement. And here for the first time we're looking at a survival endpoint, because we're taking a patient population that is unfortunately predicted to do very poorly, and survival is the goal in this study. We've highlighted in bold the definition of refractoriness to JAK inhibitor for the IMPACT-MF study, which includes treatment for at least 6 months, and an optimal dose with no dose increase, with no decrease rather, in spleen volume, spleen size, or symptoms, or being highly symptomatic on the MFSAF patient-reported outcome measure. And they have to be treated for at least 3 months at the maximal dose, and no decrease in spleen volume and or size. So it is a really a refractory patient population. This excludes patients who have intolerance to the drug, and it actually excludes patients who had an initial response that may have some degree of loss of response. So it's really picking out in many ways the patients who are the worst of the worst in terms of their expected outcomes due to JAK inhibitor refractory disease. So one of the therapies that's gotten a lot of attention and is worth covering here today is the class of agents called MDM2 inhibitors. And these are small molecule inhibitors that interrupt the interaction of MDM2, which is a protein that's upregulated in myelofibrosis patients. And it binds P53 and negatively regulates the function of P53 through multiple different mechanisms. And MDM2 inhibitors interrupt that and therefore allow for activation of P53 and the downstream consequences that ultimately lead to apoptosis. So this is a pro-apoptotic approach to the disease that's rational and mechanism-based. And KRT-232, now known as naptomadlin, is at the front of the pack of these agents in clinical development in myelofibrosis. This is a very potent MDM2 and selective MDM2 inhibitor. And this drug has been studied in a phase 2 study as a monotherapy, although there's multiple studies that are ongoing right now, including combination studies. And studies combining this drug with other rational agents like BTK inhibitors. But the study I'm highlighting here is for patients who have previously been treated with ruxolitinib and have progressive disease. Well, they're JAK inhibitor failure patients, I should say. And the definition I show you on the left of the slide is for the patients who have the relapse disease definition with progressive disease at any time while on ruxolitinib therapy, and you can see, you know, the various criterion for this type of patient versus the patients who have refractory disease on the right, who lack a spleen response after at least 12 weeks of ruxolitinib therapy and have persistent splenomegaly either by exam or by imaging or persistent symptom burden by TSS. So it is taking, again, patients who are failing ruxolitinib either by relapse definition or refractory definition, and the patients would receive the single agent naptomadlin as a salvage therapy. And the results that have been presented so far have been very encouraging in terms of the ability to capture spleen and symptom benefit, but perhaps more interestingly and more importantly, the ability to significantly reduce in some patients the driver mutation burden, the circulating CD34 cell count, and reduction in bone marrow fibrosis, all of which appear to track together and can be correlated with clinical outcomes like spleen response. So what's very interesting, I think, and important about these studies, and particularly naptomadlin, is the ability to use biomarkers that are surrogates for disease burden, such as driver mutation VAF, or circulating CD34 cell, or bone marrow fibrosis reduction, and associate and correlate that with outcome measures like spleen reduction, symptom improvement. So it really ties in the mechanism of action as well as the potential for biologic response modification with these drugs, and this is a great example of such an effort. Also worth mentioning is selinexor, which is an approved drug for multiple myeloma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This is an exportin inhibitor, this was taken into the clinic in this randomized phase 2 setting as a single agent. So again, these are patients who've previously been treated with at least 6 months of ruxolitinib. And are randomized either to selinexor at 80 milligrams once a week, and this is like about half the weekly dose than is given in multiple myeloma, or they get randomized to physician's choice, and the options are listed there, with the potential to cross over to the experimental arm. And here the primary endpoint of this phase 2 study is spleen volume reduction.
So, John, something I really welcomed with this one is that refreshingly they allow fedratinib in the comparator arm. I thought that was really nice and something we haven't necessarily seen in some of the other second-line phase 3s. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, it definitely makes it attractive from a perspective of enrolling a patient. So, It is a nice option to be able to provide the patient with a trial that gives them access in a randomized fashion, but gives them access to a study drug that has the potential to modify their disease, but is still investigational. Yet the comparator arm doesn't necessarily limit them to to a select group of drugs, but allows them to go on drug that one potentially would use if they were never introduced to this study. So that makes it, from a patient perspective, a very attractive study to enroll in. And here, again, I'm showing you the key inclusion and exclusion criteria, and I'll take your attention down to number four, which is the relapse refractory or intolerance to JAK inhibitors, which include measurement by imaging, by palpation, a spleen volume increase of greater than 25% that's documented, or intolerance to JAK inhibitor therapy. And intolerance can look like different things, and sometimes that's non-hematologic, sometimes that's hematologic intolerance, and then the usual platelet and ANC criteria. Here I'm showing you the phase two study of combination ruxolitinib and an add-on of a PI3 kinase delta inhibitor, parsaclisib. And this is a study that is built on rationale that there are other relevant signaling pathways to the pathobiology of myelofibrosis, and that there can be complementary, even synergistic effects of shutting down these hyperactive pathways, whether it's JAK-STAT or the PI3 kinase mediated pathways. And combining these two drugs, again, has preclinical data to support that. I think it's important for the listeners today to appreciate that all of the trials that we are reviewing together are all trials that had sufficient preclinical rationale and mechanistic rationale to move into the clinic and to gain the confidence to start treating patients with myelofibrosis and the buy-in of investigators that are looking to evaluate therapies and bring better therapies to patients. So I think that's very important. These are not whimsical decisions, but they're really thoughtful decisions that are supported by preclinical data. And this study is such a study that's also supported by preclinical data. And here I'm showing you the definition of what a suboptimal response to ruxolitinib is. So here, these patients are on ruxolitinib, and if they've been treated for 6 months or greater with a stable dose for at least the 2 months prior to enrollment and still have a spleen that's 10 centimeters or greater below the left costal margin, or have a palpable spleen 5 to 10 centimeters and active symptom burdens as measured by the symptom assessment score, these patients would be considered suboptimal responders to ruxolitinib and eligible for an add-on strategy. So here, one is not getting rid of ruxolitinib and moving on to the next line of therapy, but trying to salvage a response that is suboptimal in nature by adding on this oral PI3 kinase inhibitor. And this has been presented, the data has been presented previously, and what we've seen is in this randomized study that was looking at parsaclisib given at two different doses, that the 5 milligram daily dose was really the superior way of treating these patients, and this inspired the phase three study that is accruing patients currently with this suboptimal response definition, and patients are randomized either to the addition of parsaclisib as 5 milligram QDA dosing, which was shown to be the superior administration in the phase two study, or placebo, and of course this is double blind and controlled in order to assess response by spleen volume reduction at 6 months. And the idea here is, can we regain control of the spleen and symptom by adding on a drug to patients who've had inadequate response to single agent ruxolitinib?
So just like the Rux failure situation, here too with suboptimal response, there's been quite a bit of heterogeneity across, say, trials of pelabresib, navitoclax, and now parsaclisib. Do you think this is something that also needs a rigorous definition? Or do you think this is something better left to the judgment of the treating physician?
Yeah,
as to whether someone is suboptimal?
It's tricky because I think what makes all of this very challenging, whether it's defining relapse or refractory to JAK inhibitor therapy, or this definition of suboptimal response to ruxolitinib it's a moving target, and it can look different to different patients and to different physicians. So it is challenging. Of course, when constructing a clinical trial, particularly a phase three registration trial, one does need to have very strict criteria in order to deem patients eligible and have a somewhat uniform patient population in order to determine adequately determine response. But I think the real question is, how would that be utilized if it's approved in the community? Will the exact definitions of suboptimal response to ruxolitinib translate neatly into the community practice? And I don't know that I have an answer for that. I think that will be somewhat challenging. I think the reality is that if a drug like parsaclisib, for example, has positive phase three data and is reviewed positively by the FDA and ultimately approved for commercial use, you will have a different you will have different utilization of a drug like this, or any drug in this scenario, depending, I think, on the patients that are being seen at any given practice and the approach of that treating physician. I think some physicians may be more likely to add this drug on earlier on, perhaps when the patient hasn't met these strict definitions in the trial, and then other physicians may be late adopters who would be using this drug, perhaps when the patient has even, more progressive disease by definition than suboptimal response. So I think the use of it will be not uniform and not strict. It will probably be variable and hard to always define. And I don't know, to answer your question, I don't know if there's benefit to necessarily creating a very strict definition, because I think at the end of the day, it's really individualized and personalized to the patient you're treating.
No, I agree, John. I agree. Absolutely. Thank you for all your insights today. And we're going to conclude our program here. I hope it was helpful. Thank you all for listening.